Call the Transportation Committee to order, and I'm going to change the order somewhat on here this morning while we're waiting on people to get here. I'm going to do the tap-taps first, and we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2041. And close the public hearing on House Bill 2041. We'll open the public hearing on House Bill 2042. Close the hearing on House Bill 2042. Open the public hearing on 2367. Close the public hearing on 2367. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2464. Close the hearing on 2464. Open the public hearing on House Bill 2578. Close the hearing on House Bill 2578. Open the public hearing on House Bill 2668. Close the public hearing on 2668. Open the public hearing on House Bill 2947. Close the public hearing on 2947. Open a public hearing on 2954. And close the hearing on 2954.
You want to down there?
No. Open the hearing on House Bill 3135. And close the hearing on House Bill 3135. Open the House hearing on public hearing on House Bill 3187. Close the public hearing on House Bill 3187. Open a public hearing on House Bill 3445. Close the hearing on House Bill 3445. Open the hearing on House Bill 3566. Close the hearing on House Bill 3566. And open a public hearing on HJR 25 and close the hearing on HJR 25.
You would have used your freshman vice chair.
Mr. Chair,
Representative,
number, could you go through those again?
No. Let's see. Going to open a work session on House Bill 2999, Representative Beyer.
Mr. Chair, I move the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on House Bill 2999.
Representative Beyer moves the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on House Bill 2999. The reason, we passed House Bill 2999 to the Revenue Committee with the Dash 1 amendments last Friday. In discussions with the proponents, ODOT, and the Legislative Council, it was determined after the meeting that the Dash 1 amendments and original bill include refunds for below-cost sales, which was not our understanding at the meeting or anyone's intent. The purpose of reconsideration is to bring the bill back to consider substituting the Dash 2 amendments for the Dash 1 amendments. Are there any objections to Representative Beyer's motion to suspend the rules? If not, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move we reconsider the vote by which we passed House Bill 2999.
Representative Beyer moves we reconsider the vote by which we passed House Bill 2999. Is there any objection? If not, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move substitution of the Dash 2 amendments for the Dash 1 amendments in order to remove reference to the below-cost sales.
Are there any questions or objections to Representative Beyer's motion to substitute the Dash 2 amendments? If not, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2999 to the Revenue Committee with a due pass as amended recommendation.
Representative Beyer moved House Bill 2999 to the Revenue Committee with a due pass as amended recommendation. Remind Mabry that he voted no. Any discussion? Representative Mabry.
I would just reiterate the reasons for my no vote. This is not something I would throw myself on my sword over. It's clear to me that the wholesaler in delivering fuel to a service station makes a credit decision. And a part of that credit decision is to deliver the fuel with the tax included. That's not really any different than let's say the tobacco companies retailing delivering cigarettes to a Kmart or the beer companies delivering beer to Safeway, and if their credit decision turns out to be wrong, incorrect, and it doesn't pay for, then we give away the tax. The beer, wine, cigarettes, gasoline has already been sold. The fuel has already been used to travel over our roads, but we forgive the person that that made the poor credit decision the responsibility of paying fuel tax. I just think that's wrong. I think it's poor public policy, and I again respect you folks' ability to vote incorrectly from time to time, and this may be one of them, but I will be a no vote.
Thank you, Representative. Any other discussion?
Kind of surly.
Brian, will you please call the roll?
Representative Mabry.
No.
Representative Zahner.
Aye.
Representative Byer.
Aye.
Representative Dingfelder.
Aye. Aye.
Representative
Spielman.
Aye.
Representative Greenlee.
Aye.
Chair Brown.
Aye. Motion carries.
Now I'm going to pout all morning.
Don't get it
that one. I see Representative Nelson is not here yet. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2686. And Janet, could you give us a rundown on the bill?
Mr. Chair, House Bill 2686 would exempt fire apparatus, fire trucks, and equipment from statutory maximum vehicle size and weight limits and from any posted size or weight limits on particular highways or bridges. You also have before you, and this is a bill that's at the request of the Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue and Oregon Fire Chiefs Association. The Dash 1 amendments that you have modify the weight exemption. They still would allow any over-dimensioned vehicles size-wise, weight, height or width or length, but would modify the weight exemption for fire apparatus to exempt them completely from state and interstate highway and bridge postings. And for city and county streets and highways, would specify that the statutory weight limits and posted weights do not apply except on posted bridges for fire apparatus if the vehicle is under 48,000 pounds on the tandem rear axle and the loaded weight of the vehicle is below 600 pounds per inch of tire width. Mr. Chair, there's a number of people, road authorities, and the proponents here to speak to the a bill and amendments. Thank you.
Thank you, Janet. Could I have Ken Armstrong, please? John, you going to come up to it at the same time?
It's all right, Mr. Chair. I'd like to bring John over.
You bet.
Worth counties. Morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Ken Armstrong, representing the Oregon Fire Chiefs Association, Oregon Volunteer Firefighters Association, and also Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue. We brought to you House Bill 2686. Originally, we thought this was quite a simple issue, and it has turned out to be a bit of peeling back layers of an onion. The bill, as printed, provides a flat-out exemption to fire apparatus and the weight limits, and that was done when we were still in the process of trying to have some discussions and negotiations with the counties and Department of Transportation. The Dash 1s are intended to reflect those discussions. What our objective is to give fire apparatus the ability to run on highways, on local roads, and just have the exemption for that activity. The problem that we have is, currently we need to go through a variance process, and that process can be, I want to emphasize can be, it's not currently a major problem. But it can be a challenge if we've got a district such as Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue, which represents 9 cities and 4 counties, and they've got to go to each one of those jurisdictions to say, okay, we've got fire apparatus that's in excess of 34,000 pounds. We need to get a variance. That can be a time-consuming process. It can be expensive for the district when they're committing, you know, their personnel to going through that process. When it stands to reason, in our view, that it is a fairly standard weight up to 48,000 pounds on a tandem rear axle. And that is the amount that we want to get the exemption for. This is not a flat-out exemption that you see in the actual bill. The Dash 1s only allows us to go up to 48,000, and that covers almost all of the fire apparatus in the state, with the exception of the platforms, and those are things like the ladder trucks, that sort of thing, which can get considerably heavier. And there's not very many of those in the state. You still need to go through the process for that heavier apparatus, which is typically, I think, in the neighborhood of 52,000 for tandem rear axles. You still need to go through the process of engaging with the local communities, with the road authorities to get the variance. Why is this a significant issue? The primary point, and it may not be obvious, but the primary reason is these are very, very expensive pieces of apparatus. And when a fire district is looking at shopping around to purchase an engine, a pumper, some of these sorts of things, it is conceivable that they can run into some difficulty with certain manufacturers, and they don't want to actually go to that level of expense if they think that there's any chance that they might not get the variance to be able to run on those roads. Now, from a practical matter, is a city or is a county going to say, no, you can't run a 48,000-pound truck on this road? Probably not. Obviously, we've got very close relationships with the state and with the local governmental jurisdictions. We're all interested in the same thing, and that's public safety. We don't want to beat up their roads. They don't want to prevent us from responding to emergency situations. But when we're trying to buy this very expensive equipment, we feel that it's appropriate to have an exemption to the weight limits that is not in excess of something that would be reasonable. We've had conversations with Greg Delpani with Department of Transportation to try and resolve these issues. I do expect that we're going to need to come back to you with a Dash 2, because I'll bring your attention to line 9 of the Dash 1 amendments. Posted weight limits do not apply to fire apparatus on state and interstate highways. We need and we want to recognize posted weight limits on bridges in particular. That's the issue that we want to try and avoid. That's the problem that we're running into right now in some discussions with the cities, and we are in negotiations with them. They've got some concerns about the 48,000 pounds, and we want to try and resolve that. The counties, I believe, are on board with us here, as Mr. Osho will testify, but we want to make sure that this is something that works for everybody. Nobody feels like they're being run over, so to speak. I guess a bad pun. And that we get something that that resolves the problem for the fire folks. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions, and Mr. Oshel's here to talk about it from the local governmental perspective.
Okay, John.
Good morning. John Oshel, County Road Program Manager with Association of Oregon Counties. First of all, so we understand clearly, we're basically coming at this, I think it's fair to say, neutral. We've worked this hard. We've worked with the road officials. Basically, we don't want to stop fire trucks from heading down the road to a fire. We all know that and understand that. Especially when we get into the bridge issue, though, the guys have just really, you know how you really wrinkle your nose on one, but you say, okay, that's where we are on this one. They did that with sort of the provision that I do come to you and talk to you a little bit to make sure you understand just how far we are pushing the envelope with this proposal. understanding we have a history on how trucks slowly get heavier and heavier over time, that the trucks that are running on the roads now are considerably heavier than when I started designing bridges 30 years ago. Just in a 30-year period, there's been, you know, it starts off with the manufacturers seem to manufacture something that's bigger than is allowed. And then they will go hunting for exceptions. And they typically work with a service that is really needed. Fire, you see garbage haulers. You know, they sort of lead that where we need an exception here. And then they'll start with exceptions or by permit. And then they'll work into exceptions that are okay without the permit. And then they'll get some exceptions better in some states than in other states. And then the other state says, hey, look, they're doing it over there. And pretty soon it slowly evolves into now everybody can run the heavier weight. Well, what we have is another one where we're running through with the first exception for a worthy cause. No doubt about it. But we understand, when you understand how bad that exception is. Newer bridges are designed for heavier loads and are probably going to be fine on this. Out on the local system, we have a lot of old bridges. They're timber bridges designed 30-plus years ago. As I said, when I took my schooling and started my design, we designed for the classic, those of you guys know, it's HS-36 truck. Has a tandem axle load of 32,000 pounds. And we designed it with a 50% safety factor. That gets you to the 48,000 we're talking about here. But understand what that safety factor is. And for this, think in terms of a timber bridge. Think in terms of a stick that, you know, you can bend it a ways and it comes back and bend it a ways. You bend it too far, it breaks. But you can bend it quite a ways. When you're talking the safety factor, that's what you're talking about. You're bending it a little bit hard, but you're okay. When you're going to 48, you're right at the point where you bend it just before it breaks. So we got that piece going. Safety factor is the other thing that safety factor, besides just that, you know, obviously it's there because we're conservative. We're trying to save lives, keep the bridges from breaking. You're conservative, you put a safety factor in there. You got to remember in wood, you ever been down to the lumber yard hunting for your 2x4s and you start sorting through to pick out the better ones and not the other ones? Well, you know, wood, different beams have different qualities. So as you're designing a safety factor, you're working for that. You're working for the fact that, you know, when things get built, sometimes you don't see everything that's happening and something might happen during construction that loses you a little strength. That's what your safety factor is for. The other thing is that it allows you to, your wood would deteriorate with time. So what we're talking is we're saying these trucks can run at 48,000 if they're not posted. Right, so that puts the burden on us to make sure they are posted. The system in place right now, all of our bridges are inspected every other year. If there's any deterioration shown, then a new load rating is run on them to determine if a load posting is needed. So what that means is we'll get to them. There's a potential that there might occasionally be one that isn't quite ready for that 48. Now, the other thing that goes with us is we understand that this 48,000 isn't going down the road regularly every day all the time. I mean, we're talking occasional usage here. So what we're doing is we're playing that little cost-benefit gamble analysis that says what's the potential for some damage on a bridge versus getting the fire trucks to the fire. And our point, I think, where we finally came down on this is probably when you're looking at the probable, the break is probably going to be a single stringer, not the whole bridge falling in the creek. The risk of damage versus getting that truck to the fire was worth it. Dealing with the roads and being able to run on a road even when it's posted. Bear in mind, when we post roads, it's like during a freeze-thaw. What we're saying is for the occasional risk of getting the fire truck there, let's live with the damage to the road and get the fire truck there. So we've wrinkled our nose. We said, we're going to have some damage here with this. But we're nodding our head and saying, hey, to get the fire truck there is probably worth it. Detail on the bill. And we're basically said in support, but we did, when we saw this thing last night, saw some language in there that wasn't expected. Ken said he didn't even realize it was there. When you look, starting at the end of line 7, there's this phrase that says, or the combined manufacturer sidewall rating. That is not in current law. The normal posting is you got the posting by the 10 rail axles. You do have this language that says, does not exceed 600 pounds per square inch of tire width. That is what existing law is. Last session, the garbage haulers came in and requested this language you are seeing here. We basically fought it very hard. The issue being, the manufacturer will tell you how much weight you can put on it without breaking the tire. it is not the same as how much pressure you can put on it without breaking the road under the tire. And especially when you're talking bridges, that concentrated load is sitting between two stringers, and you start getting it too narrow, you can be breaking decking. So very opposed to that language. We would like to see it come out in the Dash 2 amendments when they come. Further questions?
And, Mr. Chair, we've got no problem with taking that out. That was a question of legislative counsel, and I said, frankly, I didn't wasn't aware of that particular piece. So,
okay. Representative Gilman.
In 1987, when I was here, we increased the weights for garbage trucks, if I recall.
Mm-hmm.
And people... I'm not sure we're going in the right direction here. Just because the manufacturer wants to build the vehicle heavier and not spread out the axles, I don't know. I'm not very excited about this bill.
Any other questions? Representative Honor.
Well, I can see an advantage of the bill because we start now into jurisdictional transfers of highways, you know, and say that ODOT agreed on. Okay, you can go on this piece of road, but then suddenly they transfer it to the city, and if the city then could say, well, we're going to change the rules, and then the fire department might be in some problems. So if we had a consistent rule, regardless of who was running that highway, because we're trying to think about privatizing some roads, and if we established some kind of a statute on what trucks could pass there, I think it would help from that standpoint. Does that make any sense?
Mr. Chair, Representative Zahner, it does entirely. And let me be real clear. Failure to pass this bill, that's not going to cost lives. I mean, this is not a safety issue from that standpoint, from the fire perspective. What it is instead is an effort, as I explained, to bring some consistency to the system. That, as Representative Gilman has said, if you've got certain kinds of vehicles that are acceptable at these weights, let's have fire apparatus have that same ability. We're not going to go over bridges that we know are going to fall into the creek if we drive a ladder truck over it. Well, you're not going to see many ladder trucks going over creeks anyway, but the point is the same. We're not going to be running over these very... old, kind of nearing their lifespan bridges to get to fires. But we need to be able to have the ability to get wherever we get. And as John says, this is not with much frequency. This does not occur very often, and we just need to have that consistency. But are lives going to be lost if we don't pass this bill? No, I don't want to give you that impression.
Representative Mabry.
Basically, I have, I think, two questions. One, I think I agree with George. I'm not real excited about this bill, but my mind hasn't slammed shut yet. But it is a part of the problem with manufacturing fire apparatus, fire trucks, the old standard was, I'm going to make up a number because I don't know the numbers are right, but the old standard was that, you know, a fire truck had 600 gallons of water that you carried with it. Now they want to build them with 1,000 gallons of water. Therefore, the weight limit is up. Is that what's perpetuating this?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mabry, I'm not sure how comfortable I am being very definite in a response to that.
Understand, I think I'm not tied up on a number, but
I understand.
Concept. Okay.
I understand. I think what you do find, and I would really prefer to get back to you if that's something that you're interested in having me pursue, because I've got some individuals that can give you some very detailed information on it. But my suspicion and my guess is that what you see happening is the equipment, technology is getting much better, obviously, in every facet of life. And we're seeing the same thing being the case with fire apparatus, and needs to carry more and heavier stuff with it in order to allow the emergency response personnel to be maximally effective to their maximum ability. And so you see, you know, those old fire trucks that we bring down here to the Capitol sometimes and just have a couple of ladders attached to the side, you know, that's obviously way in the past. Now there's a lot of stuff that they're carrying with them. And so I think you are seeing that ratchet up the weight a bit. If the next part of that question is where do we see that continuing to go, boy, I sure couldn't even begin to answer that.
Little add. Generally, when we look and sing the trucks, not just fire apparatus and so forth, two things drive. One is just trying to carry more and more with less vehicles, I mean, less drivers down the road and so forth. The other one, and it really applies to fire apparatus, as they try and get the bigger unit, you've got the hydraulic unit necessary to work the ladder, and it's sitting right on top of that tandem. And those hydraulic units are getting bigger and bigger, and they don't really have a way to spread it out because they have this demand for this one great big point load.
Okay. Thank you. The other follow-up, you, Ken, when you were speaking, you referred to the posted weight limits do not apply to fire apparatus on state and interstate highways, and I didn't understand that. Can you clarify it a little bit for me? I was
John, you want to cover the posted weight limits issue?
On posted, and the intent was sort of one set on the state and then the second set on the county. Bridges first. This language needs to be set up that if a bridge is posted, that's the rule. Period. End of discussion. Not negotiable. And we need to make sure the language says that. And that applies to state highways and county roads.
Okay.
What the proposal was is, I believe, on the state highways to just say, hey, they can, on the road, excluding the bridge, they can go anywhere that basically the state can't post it and stop them. And also on the counties, might have that wrong. That is, if the road is posted, the vehicle can still run down it. And the perception on that, once again, is the issue that typically postings for a road are very temporary in nature. The risk of the combination of the damage is low. But if it happens, lean towards getting the fire truck down the road and damage the road. But we need to make sure that it is very clear that once a bridge is posted, that is gospel.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Greenland.
All right, the question with that, I mean, does the Dash One Amendment say that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlee, line 9 does not for state. At line 11, posted weight limits other than those posted on bridges do not apply. That's for other than state and interstate highways. On line 9, posted weight limits do not apply to fire apparatus on state and interstate highways. That needs to have similar language as line 11.
Follow up.
What's that now? Oh, yeah. Yeah, that is different, isn't it? I mean, line 10 and 11 needs to be more like lines 12 and 13.
Can you tell me, I have two questions. The first is, what proportion of apparatus are exceeding the speed limit now? Is this a rare case? Is it only the hook and ladder, or is it?
Speed limit.
What do I say?
Speed limit.
They always exceed the speed limit.
No, they usually don't. Okay, wait a minute. But, I mean, is this most fire vehicles, 5% of fire vehicles? What are we talking about?
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlee, I would say, and I couldn't throw out a precise percent, but I would say a good number of the vehicles come up to that 48,000. I would say that a very, very small percentage, you know, there's probably less than 5 statewide exceed the 48,000, and that would still be a process where we would go and deal with each individual jurisdiction. But getting up to 48,000, there's a considerable number of vehicles that do.
Follow up.
And I understand Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue and represent them has the problem with so many jurisdictions, but is it a problem with most other fire units?
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlee, not so much from a process standpoint. It really is just a certainty of the kind of apparatus that those districts can buy. I mean, if you're dealing with a fire district in rural Oregon, they're not going to have more than one, two cities and a county to deal with. Is that really a logistical nightmare? No, it's not. It's primarily for the larger districts like TVFNR. But it is the certainty issue of being able to buy the apparatus and know that you're not going to run into problems with the jurisdictions being able to run that apparatus.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any other questions? Representative Beyer.
Yes, thank you. I happen to have this issue come up in my district, actually, before session, where I had to deal with helping them work through a variance on a truck. They needed to purchase one, got a great buy on this truck, but it exceeded the limit. We had to work through the variance to get it. Otherwise, we would have lost the truck, and it would have cost us an inordinately large amount of money extra to replace the truck with a different one. So I have mixed feelings on this. How are other states dealing with this? I mean, are other states, do they have just a higher weight limit for these apparatus, or are they doing a lot of variances? I mean, if we draw the line and we just say no, we're going to keep our weight limit at a certain amount and not go any further, I can't see us making a big impact if everybody else is allowing these companies to keep making larger and larger trucks. So, I mean, you know, what is the status of this? I mean, is somebody going to draw the line, or is it...
Mr. Chair, Representative Beyer, at the risk of putting him on the spot, I might turn back and see if Greg Del Ponte knows the answer to that. Do you know, Greg, or have any... response?
I could wait.
I don't know the answer to that.
I assume he was going to testify, and I could ask this question.
Yeah. Well, he crossed his name off the list, Mr. Chair, and so I had to make sure that he got back up here.
Put him back on.
But I asked to be back on the list.
Oh, okay, okay, okay.
Mr. Chairman, good morning. For the record, I'm Greg Del Ponte, Administrator of the Motor Carrier Division for ODOT. The specific question that Representative Beyer asked was, what do other states do? I'm aware that the allowable weight in California exceeds the axle weight that Oregon will allow, but not by much, by 2,000 pounds. I'm not aware of the specific limitations in place in the other states, but I would observe, as a general rule of thumb, if the manufacturers of this equipment are manufacturing equipment that meets this standard and carries this weight, they're doing so because there's a market for it. And so I would observe that it is quite likely the case that the equipment is able to be lawfully used in other jurisdictions. If I may, Mr. Chair, provide just a little bit of context that may be helpful to the committee. I was going to allude to the Springfield Fire Department situation that Representative Beyer broached. And in that situation, they were looking at a scarcity of manufactured equipment available to them to replace some aging equipment that was going to be taken out of service. When you're in the market, you're limited at looking what's available to you. And I think technology has changed, and there has been an emphasis on increasing the capacity of the firefighting apparatus. Their water carrying capacity, the kinds of equipment they carry, et cetera, have increased, with the result that an overall increase in the weight of the vehicle has occurred. So Representative Beyer asked, what could we do? To resolve the issue for the Springfield Fire Department, we took a look at the existing statute. The existing statute says that any road authority, state, county, or city, may issue a variance permit if they determine that it serves the public interest to do so. However, existing statute also says, however, a road authority may not do that for a load that is divisible. Then you entertain a discussion of, well, what does divisible mean? And I took a look at it, and we've defined now an administrative rule that a fire apparatus is a non-divisible load. And the commonsensical basis for that is a fire truck that is reduced by not being allowed to carry water for not being allowed to carry firefighters is a less than efficient firefighting apparatus. And so it needs to be an integral whole. And so we concluded it was a non-divisible load, and we then took the construction of the statutes to mean that we could issue that variance permit. And we did. And in issuing the variance permit, we accomplished a couple of things. By issuing a variance permit, the road authority knows who the users are. We're specifying who the users are. We define the population of to whom that privilege has been given for operating in excess of legal weights. And in addition, we have the opportunity through the permit to establish a limit. And establishing the limit accomplishes a couple of things. It does serve a public safety purpose. And so I have to take responsibility for the language in the Dash 1 amendments that no one knows the origin of, that said that in no event should the weight exceed 600 pounds per inch or the sum total of the weight carrying capacity of the manufacturer's sidewall rating. That language comes from the permit that we wrote to satisfy the Springfield Fire District's issue. And we did that. We placed that limit there for purposes of public safety and to establish an upper bound. We retain the ability to look at future instances, and we retain the ability to draw a line when we feel that an excess request has been made, and that's the value of the permit. The other piece of the permit that's important I'd call to your attention, two pieces. A permit never absolves a motor carrier or equipment operator from having to observe a posted weight limit on a bridge. The permit does not eliminate that requirement. And a permit, by issuing a permit, we have a database of to whom those permits have been issued and who is operating that kind of equipment. So we know who to communicate with in the event of a bridge failure or a bridge that is evidencing severe cracking and its weight limits have been reduced. We know specifically who to communicate with in advance so that they can have advance notice, they can plan an alternative route, or in the event of an emergency, they know what the true limits of the bridge are. And we work with the emergency response folks in that manner. We can amend the statute. And I have a great deal of respect for the Legislative Assembly, but even you folks can't amend the laws of physics. If the engineers tell you the bridge is going to collapse, if a load over X number of pounds goes over it, the bridge is going to collapse. And that's the value of the permit approach. Now, I understand what the further limitation is that I can write a permit for the Springfield Fire Department, but it only gives them the ability to operate overweight on state roads. So they also need such a permit from every other road authority whose roads they would attempt to use. So they needed a permit from Lane County, and they needed a permit from the city of Eugene if they issue such permits. And I think the core purpose behind this legislative concept, if I understand it correctly, it's streamlining. It's an attempt to avoid the process of obtaining multiple variance permits from all of the road authorities that the fire district may be operating in. And so convenience is a good thing, but I think we need to maintain an eye towards public safety by keeping some kind of an upper bound. And I personally believe it's a good idea to have a knowledge base of to whom this authority has been given so we know whom we have to communicate with in the event of a bridge failure.
Thank you, Greg. Anyone representing his honor?
How long did it take to get the variance, Greg?
3 hours.
Oh, okay. Well, I was just wondering if
the deal was in jeopardy with the manufacturer because the variance takes weeks or months.
That's quick.
Greg, and they would, the Springfield Fire Department then had, they got a variance from ODOT for state highways. They had to get a variance from the city of Springfield and a variance then from Lane County.
Mr. Chairman, any road authority that issues permits would have had to issue one. Not all cities issue permits. City of Portland issues permits. I'm not certain that the city of Eugene or Springfield does issue permits, but Lane County certainly does, and they would have had to have obtained a permit from each.
I'd like to add something. I wasn't called into this right away. They had contacted the state and had felt like the state was ready to draw the line. They were done issuing variances, is kind of the impression that the city had gotten, and called me in and asked me to help. After I contacted ODOT, 3 hours was what it took. I'm not sure how long they'd been talking to ODOT before.
Greg, ODOT does issue variances, so the assumption that Springfield made that you didn't wasn't right.
Mr. Chairman, and Representative Beyer, to respond to those questions, the construction of statute that I gave you a thumbnail sketch of was one that I made to resolve the issue. Having not been confronted with that issue and circumstance in the past, staff looked at that statute and made a call that they believed was correct, that a line had been drawn. But there was a solution simply in looking at the definition of non-divisible and then applying the statute in a lawful manner to achieve the desired outcome.
And then if that can accomplish what we want to accomplish, do we need this legislation then?
Mr. Chairman, the question is one of expediency. You have the vehicle and existing statute for every variance permit to be issued, which would be necessary for a fire department to operate this kind of equipment. The question is one of expediency and convenience, and I cannot speak to the experience that Springfield Fire Department had or Tualatin Valley had as to whether or not it was a slow or an arduous process to acquire those permits or not. Perhaps Ken can.
Representative Mabry.
I just had a question about the permit. Is it for 60 days or 60 years or the length of the, how long is a permit good for?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mabry, it's a continuous permit. It's an annual permit.
It's an annual.
Good for a year.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
Real quick, what happens if you transfer a highway? You know, let's say you've got a variance for this highway and now you transfer it over to the city. Would they also have to get a variance?
Got to go with it?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Zahner, the statute says that every road authority may issue a variance if they determine that it serves the public interest to do so. All counties issue permits. Not every city does. If I've given a variance for a state highway that is transferred to another road authority, it's that road authority's the decision whether or not they want to extend a similar variance.
Greg, then will the dash twos, as we've been talking about it, will that accomplish what we want to accomplish?
Mr. Chairman, the dash twos that have yet to be written.
Could
accomplish.
If they express the notion that we are not exempting fire apparatus from observing posted weight limits on bridges, regardless of whether it's a state or a county or a city road, that will address one of my concerns. If the Dash 2 amendments include or do not exclude existing language that applies some upper bound, that would address the second concern that I had hoped to express in my prepared testimony, which I didn't give you because it did not address the amended bill. That would address two of my concerns. The third benefit of a permit system that you will be foregoing would be the database of to whom the variance permit has been issued, so that you will no longer have the ability for the department or another road authority to communicate crisply in the event of a bridge failure with precisely those folks who have been given permission to operate an overweight vehicle along a route that now contains a fragile or damaged bridge. That'd be your trade-off, and you'd be obtaining convenience in operation for the fire districts.
Thank you, Greg. Representative Greenlock.
Yes, Greg, I just wanted to know whether you had an AC opinion, an AG's opinion or not, on whether the legislative body can indeed repeal the laws of physics.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Greenlick, it was an educated guess on my part.
Representative Mabry.
It seems to me that if bridges are, weight limits on bridges are etched in stone and not forgivable, the only time there would be weight limits on city, county, state roads would be a temporary thing because of thaw or some such thing. Seems to me that a fire department then, understanding that this is temporary, could intentionally carry 600 gallons of water instead of 1,000 gallons of water during that temporary time and solve the whole problem and not need a new law. Does that not make sense to anybody but me?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Mabry, the 600 pounds of water would not be included in the weight limit for the dual tandem rear axles. So, in other words, if you had 48,000 pounds that you were allowed, I'm not quite frankly sure about the best way to answer that question, to be honest with you. I think you're driving at whether or not if you've got a posted weight limit, that then the in the absence of this change, that the fire district would just carry less water to be able to get on to get underneath that posted weight limit. Is that what you're driving at?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, we're not talking about dry weight, so we're talking about loaded weight.
Right.
And if we're talking about loaded weight, and the reason we need this is because we're buying new apparatus.
Mm-hmm.
The new apparatus may have a heavier weight in its dry weight because of, I don't know, you got a 40-foot ladder instead of a 30-foot ladder or something on it. So that adds weight.
Mm-hmm.
But the other thing is that my old 1978 fire truck had capacity for 600 gallons of water, and the new one that I want to buy has capacity for 1,000 gallons of water, and I'm just making those numbers up. And that's a good thing, but it's something we've never had before because we've only had the capacity for 600 gallons. So what I'm getting to is on that temporary period of time, maybe it's 30 days, maybe it's 20 days, maybe it's 60 days, whatever period of time that weight limits are on, it seems only reasonable that a fire apparatus could just fill their tanks to the 600 gallon level, which would bring them down to the reasonable weight instead of the full capacity of 1,000 gallons of water, which is certainly more desirable, but not necessary to overcome the weight limit requirement.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mabry, I think one answer to that would be that not all fire apparatus are those that carry water. There's a number of there's engines, there's ladders, there's all these other types of apparatus that are not pumpers, that are not carrying water.
Same point.
Oh, okay, good. We had the same point in mind. Good. but in those circumstances, yeah, I mean, you know, maybe you could carry a little bit less water, but I think that's only dealing with one class of truck.
Chair Brown, Representative Mabry, at risk of speaking for the fire folks instead of the road folks, the issue with a water truck is you don't wait until you get the phone call to determine how much water you're putting in the truck. The truck is sitting there fully loaded, and he doesn't know what route he's going to go on until after he gets the call. And so basically what you're saying is he's going to take off down the road and then start dumping water till he gets to our road to get the weight down. The reality is if he's there, he's going to be loaded all the time.
Thank you.
And I understand that. But, you know, having had the experience of driving a tank truck for Standard Oil Company for a number of years, when load restrictions went on, I knew that I couldn't carry my full capacity of 2,000 gallons on some roads on my little tank truck because I only had, you know, single axle. And so I loaded that weight regardless of which route I might be taking for that limited period of time. When the road restrictions went away, then I loaded the full capacity of the vehicle when I left the tank farm. But and it would seem to me that you know, a fire department not knowing where a fire might be called to during this period of time would say, well, it makes sense. Let's carry a smaller amount of water than we have in the past, or than we normally would in the middle of summer, let's say, and take care of it. But
Janet, you had a question?
Mr. Chair, I just want to change the subject from weight for a minute, because the Dash 1 amendments don't make any changes on page 5 to the size limits. It still says maximum size limits do not apply to fire apparatus, so it seems like on, I don't know, height or width, could be a problem for local roads as well, but there's no change to that. Is that intended to be covered by the Dash 2s, or is it okay as it is?
You want to, is that a problem? Oh. A problem for you guys?
Well, Chair Brown, Janet, not sure quite how the term's supposed to go there. I think part of what goes with this system is we understand that the fire folks do know our road system and do know where they can go and where they can't. The reality is in many places where we would have a limit on a truck, it's under the assumption that they need to stay in their whole lane and so forth, which probably doesn't apply when you've got a fire truck running down the road with sirens and lights and so forth. Certainly if they get in a corner that's sharp, they know they got to slow down and so forth, but they do have ways to warn cars that the normal truck doesn't. And so I think our expectation is a driver who knows the road, which the fire truck drivers will be able to get there safely.
Thank you. And then, Ken, you'll be working on some Dash 2. Huh?
That's correct, Mr. Chair. Having some discussions with the cities to make sure that we can reach some comfort at their end on the 48,000. Also, a couple of the changes that Mr. Del Ponte and Mr. Oshel mentioned here this morning, we should be able to come back with Dash 2s that pretty much tighten up those issues.
Okay, thank you, gentlemen. I'll have Andrea Vogue and come up and...
Thank you.
Andrea, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'll be brief. Andrea Fogg with the League of Oregon Cities. I think you've heard of a lot of the issues around this bill this morning, and I would just say that we have committed to try to figure this out with Mr. Armstrong and the counties and ODOT, and so we'd like to take some time and do that. Obviously, the crux of this issue is safety. We need to make sure that our fire trucks can get where they need to go, but we also need to make sure that they're safely getting there across our bridges and roads. So with that, I'd answer any questions.
Okay, thank you. Any questions of Andrea? Thank you, Andrea. And with that, I'll close the public hearing on 2686. That's right. Okay, we're going to start the informational portion of the meeting on the road user fee task force report, and if I could get Jim Quiddy in. Good morning, Jim. Thank you for coming. We have Representative Nelson has a bill we're going to hear this morning, so we may have to interrupt you when she makes it here. Thank you again.
That's just fine. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Jim Whitty with the Oregon Department of Transportation. I am the administrator for Transportation Funding Task Forces. I have the work of one task force to discuss with you today, the Road User Fee Task Force. And you're receiving right now the report of the task force to the 72nd Legislative Assembly. The Road User Fee Task Force is formed actually by the legislature from last session, 71st session, and appointed by the governor, Senate president, and Speaker of the House in November 2001. The Road User Fee Task Force is long-term. It sunsets on January 2nd, 2010. And we'll go into why that is. It's a long-term piece of work. The legislative mandate in House Bill 3946 was to develop a design for revenue collection for Oregon's roads and highways that will replace the current system for revenue collection. Now, why did the 71st Legislative Assembly have that concern? Oregon is heavily dependent upon fuel taxes. This slide describes basically the budget for ODOT, where the funds come from. And if you look at the fuel tax element, it is a very large component, state and federal fuel taxes. It comprises 70% of the road revenue. So if this revenue source is challenged in any way, you can see that the total road revenue will be difficult to sustain over time. One big reason that the gas tax revenue is becoming less dependable for our Oregon for our roads is fuel efficiency of the vehicles. In 1970, the average passenger vehicle in Oregon got about 11.8 miles per gallon, and now we're at actually for 2002, I understand we're at 19.7 miles per gallon. So this has an effect on road revenues. I have a series of charts here that will describe what's been happening. As you see, there's a continual upward trend of gasoline consumed in Oregon. As more motorists or more residents enter Oregon, and the average motorist drives more miles per year. The upper line here, which is pink, indicates the amount of gasoline that would have been consumed but for fuel efficiency. You see, back in 1960, every passenger vehicle got about the same miles per gallon, which is 8 to 10 miles per gallon. You had an occasional model that would get something a lot better, like a Volkswagen Beetle, but for the most part, cars got 8 to 10 miles per gallon. And then with the fuel crisis or the oil crisis in the 70s, you started to see a separation. Some vehicles got high miles, other vehicles got low miles per gallon. While this effect is good for air quality and good for resource consumption, it has a poor effect on road revenues. Oregon and all other states in the country have not adjusted to account for this trend, other than occasionally raising the fuel tax. So road revenue, as you can see here, it roughly mirrors the trend in gasoline consumption, although this period right in here was when we raised the gas tax quite a bit to account for the drop-off in road revenue related to fuel efficiency and inflation. As you can see, though, at the end, though, we haven't continued that trend, and yet the trend towards fuel efficiency and inflation still has continued. This top line here represents the difference in road revenue that would have occurred, but for fuel efficiency in the vehicles increasing. Total difference. $10 billion over that period of time. The upper line now is the line for inflation added on top of that, and that adds another $5.7 billion lost during that time. Now, we probably wouldn't have lost the whole $15.7 billion during that time because there wouldn't have been the need to raise the fuel tax as much in the 1980s. But it does demonstrate that there's a the effect of fuel efficiency and inflation on the gas tax revenues is great. Yet, ever greater demands are made on our road system. This is the VMT, vehicle miles traveled in the state, red line. You see it's going up quite a bit, and the other two lines are lane miles and center lane miles, and they haven't gone up much at all since 1960. The future of the gas tax is seriously at risk because of technology. As you can see, the hybrid electric gets around 45 miles per gallon. You're seeing ever more of these on the road these days. Standard vehicle is approximately 20 miles per gallon. The hybrid electric has made it to the point of acceptability. You're going to see more and more models. We are tracking this, the developments in the marketplace. You're going to see more and more models, standard models, that have this capability. The American motor companies are now coming out with models. You'll see them in 2004, and you'll see probably in up to a half the models within 5 years will have this capability as an option for the cars. It works. And you've read about the fuel cell vehicle as well. The Bush administration has committed a great amount of resources for developing this vehicle. There's differences of opinion as to when it could enter the marketplace. Most opinion is about 10 to 15 years we'll have a vehicle that's affordable. So the future is the gas tax revenue will not be the primary source for funding your roads. This is a new chart for those of you that have been looking at this before. This is the prediction for when we'll start to have a dramatic effect of fuel-efficient vehicles on the marketplace and a reduction in gas tax revenue. The upper line is what the revenue would be, but for new improvements in fuel-efficient vehicles. And the lower line is what it will be, according to the predictions. As you can see, the fuel tax revenues will level off in about 8 years. And in 2014, the revenue reduction will be $15 million per year and grow greater every year after that. So that's the purpose for the Road User Fee Task Force to do its work. It held 9 meetings over the course of the past 16 months, 3 public hearings, 3 major research reports, and a preliminary report presented to the legislature last September. The Road User Fee Task Force looked at some 28 different revenue mechanisms and adopted these parameters for design of a new system. It should be a user pay system, according to the task force, and not usurp a local government source, provide adequate revenue to replace the gas tax, be transparent to the public, not hidden, there be a minimal non-governmental burden, be enforceable, and support the entire public and highway road system. It should be acceptable to the public. This will be a challenge. Any change is a challenge. And it was designed without additional revenue in mind for now. This is the task force decided that new revenue or the level of revenue is a matter for the legislature, not for the task force. This is a list, partial list of the revenue mechanisms considered. They are listed in your report at page 24. I won't read these off. You can take a peek if you're interested. The recommendations the task force has at this point in time is for a mileage-based fee for a broad revenue mechanism to replace the gas tax. It also suggests 2 targeted revenue mechanisms, or 3, for special problems, congestion pricing, new facility tolling, and studded tire use permit. I'll go into these now. Mileage fee to ultimately replace the gas tax. This is discussed on pages 27 through 38 of the report. The policy recommendations for developing this fee is that it be accurate, that it be that the technology used, because this will be a technology-based collection system, reliable, secure, and technologically feasible, that there'll be a minimal evasion potential, and not cover mileage outside of the state of Oregon. Incidentally, the gas tax does cover mileage outside the state of Oregon. It averages out, though, when you come back. So, but there'll be a minimal burden on the private sector, that any retrofitting be affordable, that there'll be a seamless transition. We'll have minimal loss in the transition, and then it protect privacy. The good news is, I think, other than retrofitting, which we may not do, I think we can meet all of these. How the collection would work. The task force looked at six different ways to collect the mileage fee, and decided ultimately that we have to leave our options open and not settle in on any particular one. There's a lot of reasons to choose one or the other, not the least of which is politics. And so we're having a pilot project that starts this year. We should design that pilot to support a number of possibilities. So the fee collection would occur at either a centralized system or service stations. The data collection would be calculated by either a GPS, a global positioning system, or an odometer tag. Two different systems we're going to test. Data transmission be by radio frequency, and the payment would be probably a monthly billing or at the fuel purchase. I want to go through this a little bit. The GPS device, as you see, it receives a signal from a satellite down to the receiver in the car. Now, we had a lot of media earlier this year, in January and February, about this, as people got all upset about using a GPS device, thinking, oh my, they're going to track us. The way this would be designed would be no ability for tracking. GPS device does not send out a signal to tell anybody where it is. It only receives a signal. If you want the information about where you are to go, for somebody else to get it, you have to have a transmitting device attached to it. There's a broad range, like cellular. This is how rental car companies know where the rental unit is. You can attach a transmitting device that doesn't have a broad mechanism, doesn't have a broad area, can only go a few feet, which is what we'd be suggesting, by radio frequency. So you just go by a reader at a gas station. It doesn't go any further than that. Not only that, so it couldn't go to a main system anywhere. All it would do is transmit miles that are calculated in a computer in the car. So the privacy issue was overblown. Needless to say, though, we have another option for collecting miles. So anyway, computer collects the miles in there, and then it goes transmitted to the gas station point of sale system, and then it could be added to a bill at the gas station. Another possibility is that we use an odometer tag. It's an electronic calculation of the miles driven, and that data is then transmitted to the fuel pump. So we're looking at both of those possibilities. We have issues that need resolution. Retrofitting is difficult because it's expensive. These devices may be affordable, but when you retrofit, the cost goes up dramatically. So that may not be something that's ultimately recommended. The alternative would be to phase in this system over a period of time by requiring the manufacturers to meet certain specifications for putting the device or a device in the car, and then new vehicles would pay the mileage fee, and older vehicles would pay the gas tax during the transition period. When you're running two systems at once, you'd have to have a credit of the gas tax against the vehicle against the mileage fee. And that's the recommendation. Non-resident drivers would continue to pay the gas tax until other states adopted a similar system, in which case you could integrate the two. We are working feverishly to reduce the administrative costs of doing this. If we collect at the fuel station, the administrative cost goes way down to roughly what the gas tax administrative cost is. It's very, very inexpensive. If we use a centralized system, the administrative cost goes up a lot. Now, the rate. Based on the current level gas tax, is about 1.22 cents per mile, based on the average automobile getting 19.7 miles per gallon. If the administrative cost was to be high, you'd have to capture that in the rate. The rate will be a tough political issue. Here's why. If we charge a flat rate per vehicle, then highly fuel-efficient vehicles now in the marketplace, now on the roads, will have a disadvantage relative to the current gas tax. They pay very little gas tax compared to the high or to the low miles per gallon vehicles. If we do a flat rate, the low miles per gallon vehicles would be advantaged. The Road User Fee Task Force decided there are so many variations you could do to the rate that they elected not to mess with it, to recommend a flat rate. And basically, if and when we pursue legislation at the legislature to implement something like this, the battle for the rate would be in this at the legislature, which is probably appropriate. It's going to be a political issue. There are a lot of variations that could occur. You could change the rate by geography, by emissions, by weight, by length. You could have a local piggyback. The only one the task force agreed to go forward with would be congestion pricing. In some places, you might want to have a higher rate during certain periods of the day to deal with congestion. And the principal reason for that is that that the task force recommends that is funding. We are 80% funded by federal funds, and the federal program wants us to look at this issue. So we're pleased to do that for them. Congestion pricing, the strategy there would be it would only be applied in regions where high congestion exists and where it might help with the flow of traffic. The concept would be area pricing. If you enter an area, then the rate would change if you enter an area during specific periods of time of high congestion, and that the dollars would be spent on modernization. Now, this one is actually a way out there idea. I think we've all heard of congestion pricing, but it's not going to actually be applicable in the state until every car has the appropriate device in the car. So this is some 20 years out. The reason is it's a matter of the equal treatment under the Constitution. You cannot have some paying the congestion rate and others not. So this is a long-term look, and it may never need to be switched on if politically it's not acceptable. Because it's just merely something to add to a mileage fee. It can be turned on or off at any point in time.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah, Representative Dinkfeller.
Thank you. I just wanted to ask you a question, Jim, about that, because I've been working with Metro on this issue for years, and congestion cost pricing has different effects. And I know that you're talking right now about replacing the gas tax, but also the whole idea that behind congestion cost pricing is you're trying to alleviate congestion. So I guess I just want to clarify about what context you're looking at it for, because as far as a pricing mechanism, it may not be the most politically expedient, but as far as looking at tools to manage congestion, so I guess I just wanted to ask if that came up or you discussed that in the task force.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dinkfelder, the task force was very clear about what its mission was. Its mission was about revenues,
mm-hmm.
How to maintain revenues for the system long term. So the task force was didn't want to go into other societal issues. It's basically outside of its responsibility. So it didn't go into the efficacy of managing congestion for congestion pricing. It basically believes that those issues are a matter for other policymakers to make. Congestion pricing is, however, a user fee, and that you are managing the money that's raised would go back into improving the road that's congested. So the task force looked at it from that vantage point and decided that it's worthy of consideration for the purposes of raising revenue for a particular road that has needs, but didn't look into it for purposes of managing the traffic flow. That's a different issue. And probably a valid one from that's been researched by many up to this point.
Thank you.
Other two targeted revenue systems, new facility tolling. We didn't go into a great analysis of this except for to look at any new major capacity that's added to the system. the task force believes should be paid for by itself, if feasible. This means if a new road, a new lane, a new bridge comes in, it ought to be tolled. That's the attitude of the task force. And then studded tires. The task force looked at the damage caused by studded tires right now and noted that the entire passenger vehicle fleet pays for the damage that's created by studded tires and recommended a studded tire use permit. And actually, there's legislation in this house for that. Actually, I think it's in this committee for that. The timeline, the report has been submitted to the legislature. Right now we're assembling the pilot test technology. Our pilot tests last from now until 2006. And then we start implementing the pilot test in June 2003. Pilot test will be in two phases. First one is to do a functional test of the technology. Will it work the way we want it to? And we have hired researchers at Oregon State University to do this. They have a mobile technology unit, as luck would have it, and they've been helpful to us up to this point, and they'll be helpful to us in developing the technology. The technology actually exists now. It's just never been put together for this purpose. So this is what they're doing for us. Along about next March, we will apply the technology to real human beings who want to participate in the pilot, and then they'll run that for about 2 years or so. Legislation 2139, I think, is in this committee. Coming along is Senate Bill 83, which is the pilot program implementation. We actually have the authority to do the pilot now. We are concerned about the authority to do the congestion pricing element that the feds require us to do as part of this pilot. And so the Senate Bill 83 would allow us to do that. It doesn't do anything more than allow us to do that for purposes of a voluntary pilot. In closing, I'd like to point you to the list of frequently asked questions that was prepared. I prepared this in February following the flurry of media activity surrounding our work, and I learned what the frequently asked questions were. So I tried to write them as close to English as I could so I could hand them out to the media, ordinary citizens, and the legislature, and they have a reasonable idea of understanding what we're doing. Should a question occur to you, chances are it's on the list. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Jim. I want to commend you and your committee for the hard work that you've done. You've worked very hard on this issue, and I realize it's a work in progress, but you've accomplished a lot. And the question of when Senate Bill 83 was heard over in the Senate side, there was some real concerns about the invasion of privacy that comes about whenever you're tracking where people are moving around. How do you overcome that? Is there a way to ever overcome it?
Yeah, in fact, there is. The way we're designing these devices, there's just no ability to track. If you can design them large so tracking can occur, or you can design them small so it doesn't have the capacity to do it. GPS devices where there's tracking involved, you have a location, and then down the road you have another location. The computer on board the car knows where the first location is. When you get to the second location, it knows where that is. So it can transmit those locations if it has a transmission device that's broad, like a cellular, and then somebody who has a receiver on the other end could know where you're moving. If you don't have a broad receiver, if you have a little short radio frequency transmitter, which is what we're looking at, it might be able to transmit the location, but it would only go 10 feet. Nobody's going to be able to use that, so it will calculate the mileage that way, and then when it goes into a gas station, the mileage would then be transmitted, and you can configure it so it only transmits the mileage, so there would be no knowledge of where you are or where you're going. And it's just a very small way to do it. We told the researchers at OSU, we want to have no ability to know where anybody is. All we want to do is transmit mileage when you go past a reader at a gas station. And so we're designing that so there will be no possible way to know where anybody is, because we're very sensitive to the public's concern. But we're so sensitive to it that we are researching the other device, odometer tag, which just calculates mileage as well, so that if the letters GPS become too much of a burden to overcome, we'll put it aside, even if it's maybe the better way to go from an electronic standpoint, so that we could use something that would work and maybe not be quite as it might not be able to support the congestion pricing, but we wanted to be able to have another device in case the letters GPS became too politically difficult. So ultimately the goal is no privacy issue, either functionally or politically.
Thank you, Jim. Representative Dingfeld.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks, Jim. I had a question about are there any other states at all that are using VMTs to fund their transportation at this time? And if so, if you can, or if pilot projects that have been done. I'm just not that familiar.
Yeah. This is a good question. I'd say Oregon is in the lead on this, just as we were in 1919 when we passed the first gas tax in the country. There is a consortium of states working out of Minnesota that are looking at this from more of a congestion pricing element. They're looking at the same technology issues, and they will be doing a pilot too. But I can't, and we have our money in hand to do this pilot. They do not. So I suspect they will, but so there will be a couple of pilots going on at roughly the same time. But we are in the lead on this.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Representative Breyer.
Thank you. And I don't know whether we really need to get into all these details, but in this, how would you differentiate miles traveled in Oregon as opposed to miles traveled outside of Oregon?
The way these devices would work is that they would shut off for purposes of calculating miles when you go across the border,
okay,
and then turn back on when you come across the border. So now, the way this would work, however, during the transition period, if somebody figured out a way to damage the device or thinks they could drive across the river, say, and then come back on a gravel road in northeast Oregon, they would still pay the gas tax. And ultimately, the gas tax, once the full phase-in goes in, might be fairly high to account for that, to make that inadvisable.
Any other questions? Thank you, Jim. Appreciate you coming here today. Let's see, what bill is that there? 3253. Mm-hmm. I'm going to open a public hearing and possible work session on House Bill 3253. And have Janine Delaney and Jacqueline Jones. Good morning.
Good morning. Stephen Middleton is open. Excuse me, Mr. Chair. Were you going to hear a presentation from Representative Nelson's staff? I believe.
Do we have someone here from the staff? Certainly. Join us up here.
Okay. I'll hold my comments until after he's spoken,
okay,
if you don't mind.
All right.
Thank you.
What was that? Okay. Good morning.
Chair Brown, members of the committee, good morning. My apologies for the delay here. Representative Nelson has been held up in the district, it seems. So I will offer her testimony for her. I am Matt Metter, her legislative aide. You've been given a copy, I believe, of the testimony, of her testimony, and a copy of the bill, House Bill 3253. And I will read her testimony verbatim here. Chair Brown and members of the House Committee on Transportation, I thank you for your consideration today of House Bill 3253. Throughout our great state, parking for some of our most vulnerable citizens is abused regularly. In Oregon, there are thousands of disabled drivers who must fight for the right of accessible parking every day. House Bill 3253 will help stop abuse of disabled parking laws and reserve disabled parking spaces for those who need them most and are legally entitled to use them. Only about 4% of all parking is reserved for disabled drivers. With the numbers of senior citizens and disabled people increasing each year, designated disabled parking is becoming harder and harder to find. Existing Oregon law requires most public buildings in the state to be accessible to and usable by persons with disabilities as provided in the Americans with Disabilities Act. The intent of original disabled parking legislation, was to provide the easiest possible access for disabled people to move to and from their automobiles and the buildings near which they had parked. When a disabled person uses disabled parking but does not actually enter or leave his vehicle, he unnecessarily occupies scarce space that is truly needed by another disabled person who must actually traverse with difficulty the distance between his vehicle and his destination. Today you'll hear from the father of a disabled 7-year-old boy who on a daily basis is affected by the very situation House Bill 3253 will correct. This boy, Ian Terudic, has experienced at least 2 close calls in traffic as he has moved across the parking lot in front of his school because the existing designated disabled parking spot is occupied by a disabled driver who neither enters nor leaves his vehicle while he waits to pick up his able-bodied grandson. It is this sort of abuse of disabled parking permits that House Bill 3253 will correct. Thank you for your support and your time on behalf of Representative Nelson.
Thank you. Why don't we go ahead and take the rest of the testimony, and then we'll open it up to questions.
Okay. For the record, my name is Janine Delaney, and I'm testifying on behalf of the Oregon Disabilities Commission. And let me reassure the committee that I neither drive nor park in disabled parking spots. But I did talk to a number of people about this bill to try to get a handle on the bill. And we've got... It's difficult. There's certainly abuse of disabled parking permits, and nobody's going to deny that. The difficulty with this bill is we don't believe that it fixes the issue because, first of all, it's an enforcement nightmare. And already the whole enforcement with the volunteer parking patrols, many of them have been way curtailed in terms of the budget cutbacks, and so enforcement is already troublesome in this area. Also, it puts the emphasis on proving that you have a disability. And, for example, I have a friend who's a wheelchair user who has a wheelchair-accessible van. Her partner has severe congestive heart failure. They go somewhere together in her van with her placard, and he gets out of the vehicle. He does park in a disabled parking spot, gets out of the vehicle to go into the store. Well, he doesn't look disabled. So are they going to get ticketed because, they parked in the space when, in fact, he needs it as much as she does? I think this bill just doesn't get there. And while we don't deny that there's huge issues with abuse of disabled parking, for example, doctors need a lot more education about when to give them out. They sort of give them out as courtesy rather than to people who really need them. I just don't think that this bill will get us to where we need to go, both because of the enforcement issues and because it makes people prove whether or not they're disabled, or the enforcement judgments are based on stereotypes and assumptions which may or may not prove true, and then somebody's dragged into court to have to prove that they were entitled to this parking place. Thank you.
Thank you. Jacqueline, would you... like to give your testimony?
Jacqueline Zimmer Jones, Oregon Association of Area Agencies on Aging and Disabilities. Thank you for your time. And Matt, I appreciate the testimony because if you look at this bill just as it stands, it's unclear really what issue they're actually attempting to tackle here. And it looks like what we've done is created a statewide standard for solving a problem it looked like a statewide standard for solving a problem somewhere, but you couldn't really identify from the bill itself what the problem is. And I sympathize with Ian and his family when he's put at risk. And I believe that if Ian has a disability, that his family is allowed probably to park wherever they need to make sure that he can get to and from where he needs to go safely. And I don't understand whether or not Ian and if they've had a conversation with this elderly grandfather about whether or not he should really consider moving along so that someone else can have that spot for purposes of safety. But what I wanted to say was that there has been some work by this legislative body to amend the disability parking situation, because there is widespread abuse of it. And primarily last session, the issue was Portland, where people do photocopy. They use great printers and they photocopy handicap placards. They do sell them in Portland and other parts of the state. And then downtown Portland has a problem with people parking all day long for free because they have a disability parking permit. And so when we saw this bill, we weren't sure where it came from because we did just see it just a night before last. So we thought perhaps that's what this bill might have been trying to get at. The one thing that I want to point out, though, is that in the case of people with disabilities, independence and dignity, I think, are two things that we just can't put a price tag on. And the value of somebody still being able to travel about in their community in their vehicle, even though they are disabled, is something that we support. And so I'm not sure about whether or not this law would sort of create opportunities for people to go up and literally challenge people who are disabled, make them prove their disability on the spot, make them prove that the parking placard is theirs. And so I have some concerns about just people being approached perhaps when they really don't need to be, about whether or not they deserve to be in the spot they're in. So, you know, I appreciate the situation that generated this bill. We think that it probably opens up the door for some people to face harassment that they really don't need to. I would certainly be willing to sit down with the bill's sponsors and talk to them a bit more about odds and opportunities for making something like this work, but probably would have a difficult time being in support of it right now. Thanks.
Thank you. Is there any questions? Representative Zahn.
Do the handicap permit holders, is that permit on the car, is that the only thing, or do they also get something that would identify them in their wallet, like on their driver's license, so that if they were questioned, even though they walked out of the car and looked like they were in good shape, they could pull out their wallet and say, see, here it says that I am whatever.
Mr. Chair, Representative Zahner, I think that Kelly from ODOT is here and will be able to answer these things a little more technically. But again, the question is, do we go up and challenge people when we should we assume that people do not have a disability? Do we go up and challenge people in the parking lot at Fred Meyer's just because we think they should show us whether or not they are in fact disabled? So that's sort of our perspective. But Kelly can tell you, I think, a little bit more about the actual rules. So,
and I could answer that question, Chair Nelson and Representative.
Okay.
Chair Brown, I'm sorry. got confused there. You carry the ID or driver's license that's associated with the placard that connects. Those two numbers connect. But people don't carry anything necessarily that identifies them as a person with a disability. So unless it's visibly obvious, you know, they don't carry something like that. And I don't think that's what we intend, is to make somebody carry something that says they have a disability.
Thank you.
I think, Mr. Chair, they do put glasses on driver's license. So I think that's the only limitation that you see.
Thank you. Representative Greenlee.
Hi, Jackie. Thank you for coming. I guess I have a couple of questions. And I guess one is, my assumption is that the commission has not taken a formal stand against this bill. Is that
the Oregon Disabilities Commission?
Yeah.
Janine would be the
we
director of that.
At this point, we have said that we have some major concerns with it. We haven't taken a stand in support or against. We just think it's not going to work the way it is, and it would take some considerable amendments to make it work.
And if I may follow up, sir.
Follow up.
You seem concerned that people will show up and start challenging disabled people. And my understanding is we create statutes and then we have law enforcement that enforces the statute. I mean, as much as I want to go after that reckless driver on I-5, I don't go challenge them. I wait frustrated until the state police come or don't come, as the case may be. Is this your sense here that by putting this statute on the books, when I see that stupid 21-year-old drive up at Fred Meyer's Park in the disabled parking and strut off to get a pack of cigarettes, I'm going to go attack that person and find out whether they really do have congestive heart failure or not?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlick, I did talk to you about challenging people, and I know that people are challenged. People do grumble about people parking in disability spots that do not look like they're disabled. And since I represent persons with disabilities, I'm here to tell you that you just don't always know whether or not someone has a disability, even if they're 21, even if they go in to buy cigarettes. And so I think people do feel free, because when you're traveling down the freeway and you're upset about someone driving, you can't pull them over and have a discussion with them. But if you're going into the same store that they are, you're free to make an offhand comment to them or to actually sort of get in their face about it if that's the kind of mood that you're in. So people do have, I think, strong feelings. And, in fact,
and
as a result of that...
Now, though, right, under the... I mean, I'm free to act... ignorantly under the current statute. This isn't going to... We've heard testimony that you can't repeal human... the laws of physics. I assume this isn't going to change the laws of human nature either.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlee, it isn't, except that it actually puts something on the book that says, prove it. Prove to me that you have this disability, and then I'll leave you alone.
It says, prove to me that that's your permit. But, I mean, but.
Either way. I mean, either way, so.
Mr. Chair, if I may, Mr. Trudick can also address some of these issues from a somewhat different perspective. So I encourage you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, to ask Mr. Trudick as well and hear his testimony,
okay,
which I think is coming up here soon.
Is there any other questions? Thank you. I have Andy Trudick.
Good morning, Mr. Chair.
Good morning.
I am Andy Cabrudis, and as I was introduced by Matthew, I'm the father of a disabled child. I also have some experiences myself as a temporarily disabled person. As you can see, I could probably do jumping jacks for you today, and I'm not parked in illegally in a disabled spot. I used to do this for a living, so...
Oh, that's what you're saying. Oh, we can do it that way, sure.
Okay, so what this bill proposes is the closure of loopholes in the ORS 811.615 and some subsequent articles, which presently allows healthy persons, by the wording, to exploit parking reserved for mobility-challenged members of our society. These are people who have difficulty moving maybe even 30 or 40 feet. And a healthy person parking in that spot because they have a placard, a placarded person beside them, occupies a very scarce resource. We looked up some statistics this morning from some government sources, and there are over 100,000 placard holders in Oregon. And the parking spaces that were allocated, that law was passed several years ago, and as you know, we've got an aging population, we can expect the number of placard holders to increase as people get arthritic. And I mean, I'm feeling pains in my joints at 45, so you know, I can imagine what it's going to be like in 20 years. Anyway, we should allow disabled people to function normally and to access facilities. As a matter of fact, we're mandated by the Americans with Disabilities Act to allow people with disabilities to function as normally as possible in society. That means being able to drop a letter at the post office. That means being able to get your groceries and function as independently as you wish to function. And we should recognize that the resources for accessibility are limited. The resources for enforcement of such things are limited. So we are bounded by a number of conditions. So I'm sure everybody in front of your committee is motivated by something. I've come here today because I have a disabled 7-year-old son. He is an Oregonian. He was born at Best Kaiser in Portland. He's 7 years old. He can't talk. He has autism. He has Down syndrome. He's still in diapers and probably will be for quite a few years. He was a preemie. He's the first of a set of quads that we had. So we have 4 children, 7 years old. He can't walk yet. We're hoping that with the intervention from the school that he will eventually walk. But as I say, he's 7 years old and he can't walk. He has a rather petite mother. She's about 120 pounds, and she has to carry him. And he's about 45 pounds now. And you can imagine, you know, diaper changes and lifting a child into and out of a crib that he sleeps in daily and taking him to and from school. And like I said, he can't walk. So she has to do all of that. Despite Ian's disabilities, he is a member of society. He does go to school each day. He's enrolled in a life skills program at Dundee Elementary. Dundee is in the Newburgh School District, and it's the only life skills designated school for that district. So we're forced to drive him 28 miles a day to and from school, that was typically done by his mom, but I'm one of those unemployed high-tech guys that you've read about in the paper, and I've been unemployed for 8 months now, so I get to take him to school once in a while. In any case, Ian does go between his classroom and car. His teachers actually pull him in a little radio flyer type of wagon. It's fairly low, and as I said, there have been some incidents that we can talk about here. I'm not sure procedurally how this works, but I think it's okay if you interrupt me if you have any questions on any of this. The ORS for disabled parking allows any permit holder to park in a disabled designated space. And the key word there is you're allowed to park. You don't have to get out of the car. So that means that, for instance, if I'm an old arthritic person who is sitting in the passenger seat and I have my grandson driving me to the grocery store, my grandson can park the vehicle. I have my ID, which is either a driver's license or an Oregon ID, which matches up with the placard, but my grandson can run into the store. And while that's occurring, a truly disabled person that can't walk or is on crutches, as I was during a couple of summers, can't get into the grocery store because that spot is occupied. And I was damaging my knees by walking 200 feet from a parking spot to get my groceries because my wife wasn't around at the time. So in any case, if you go to Dundee Elementary, I invite you to, at about 2:50 p.m. in the afternoon, you will find a placard holder legally parking in the disabled spot, and it's nearest to the doors. And the disabled children are unloaded from these doors into the special bus that's provided, or, as I said, to people like ourselves that actually commute their children to and from school. So each day, a perfectly healthy grade schooler enters or exits this vehicle, and there is no legal recourse. We've talked to this person nicely. I mean, this isn't any kind of a duel of weapons or pointing guns at each other or anything. We've just pointed out nicely, can you park in the spot? won over even, because the person gets there 20 or 30 minutes early just to get the spot. So what's my wife going to do? Is she going to spend, you know, her day as a member of the household and taking care of the house and animals and everything else, and then have to come to school half hour early to beat this guy to the spot that my son needs? And it's like I said, it's just sort of escalating. But this is a global problem. This isn't just specific to us. On two separate occasions, this very vehicle, when he was pulling out, almost ran over my son. As I said, he's pulled out in a wagon. It's very low. The visibility is very limited. And, you know, had we had access to the nearest spot, it would be a direct shot from the door. The teachers wouldn't be at risk either. It wasn't just my son. The teacher almost got ran over as well. She had to do some pretty heroic moves in order to prevent a tragedy. Okay, so my own experiences, I'm also here in the capacity of being a temporarily disabled person. I broke my knee up in Canada on a business trip and had some pretty severe complications and a misdiagnosis by a non-medical person that put me on crutches for 6 months for nothing. In any case, a total of about three periods, and it's about a total of about a year that I was actually very immobilized, to where, you know, there were occasions where I could barely make it from the living room to the bedroom. In any case, I came to appreciate the ADA. It's something that you take for granted as a healthy person. If you've never had to have a placard, congratulations. It's something that you don't want to have. Okay? It's I'm sure any disabled person would love to have the privilege of not having a placard. The opposite's also true. There are the lazy members of our society who think that they're better than anybody else, who are more than willing to color photocopy placards for their own personal benefit. They could care less about a person suffering further injury because the spot is convenient to them, where they're not bothered with looking for a parking place. I was still able to travel because of the facilities society put in place. I was in marketing for a semiconductor company. I was able to travel internationally. It's just great, the things that people have put in place. Wheelchair you onto the airplane. As I said, facilities everywhere for a disabled person to be able to function. And I was able to hold my job. Lufthansa was a little bit interesting. I'll just get a little bit off topic. You actually get a disabled seat on their airplanes in business class. And you get all of the business class amenities. You know, you're kind of wondering, these Germans are great people. But, you know, when you're on a two-hour flight, you get to thinking, this is the furthest seat from the exits. So it wasn't all gracious. In any case, I am a summer bachelor. My wife actually goes with the children to go visit grandma in Illinois. And I was actually on crutches during that period, and I had to do my own errands. And I got to see healthy people running in and out of cars. I mean, go to the post office, I'm only going to be a minute, right? So they just dash in and do their mailings or whatever in 5 minutes or whatever. But as I said, there's the inconvenience in forcing a person, because you've got a lineup of people behind you while you wait for that spot. And now you're inconveniencing somebody else, and they don't understand that you're waiting for that spot. Grocery store, again, a disabled person waits in the car while a healthy person goes in to do their shopping for them. Why can't they park in a regular spot and have the healthy person go just as a regular healthy person would? I think that's an abuse of discretion. That's what this bill is intended to address. I realize that there are issues with people holding placards now or not holding placards now and enforcement. Those are not going to go away with this. What this is intended to do is to deter healthy people from abusing the very rare amount of spaces that are available. So the questions that we need to ask ourselves, I mean, this can be a very emotional issue, as you saw with the people that were testifying here before you a few minutes ago. It's really a question of which person's rights supersede another person's rights. And under the Constitution, we're all supposed to be treated fairly and equally. I sort of drew a little graphic here. There's heading up in this direction on my bullets is the selfish need, and heading down this way is the physical need. You know, it's a matter of debate, but I think everybody here would agree that a healthy person with no placard should get a lethal injection for parking in a disabled spot. It's like I said, a very selfish act. It's not. All right, maybe the chair. But anyway, now a disabled placard holder parking in a designated place, that's currently permitted by the ORS. If you take a look at the way that it reads, a disabled person with a placard can park. They don't have to get out of the car. They can just park. So as I've witnessed on a daily basis at the school, we have a disabled person that sees this as an earned right because they are disabled. They have a placard, and they know that they can park, regardless of whether or not it takes up a valuable space. And meanwhile, his chubby grandson gets a close spot and doesn't have to get much exercise. Now, a disabled placard holder parking in a designated place with a healthy person running in and out, again, that's permitted by ORS. If you challenged the person to produce a placard and a matching ID, it would be there, and therefore there would be no way to have that person displaced from the spot. Now, right now, a disabled placard holder parking in a designated spot to actually access the facilities, that's actually permitted as well. But this person actually has the physical need. They actually cannot get to or from a facility that is displaced more than, like I said, maybe 30 or 40 feet. This is the type of person that this is concerned with. As I said, I can do jumping jacks in front of you. This isn't about me. This is something I discovered on the way with some things that we had discovered ourselves. So what this bill proposes is that a disabled placard holder may park in a designated place, as they can now, but they have to actually access the facility. They can't.
Excuse me, just a minute. I have a floor session at 10:45, and so I'll be able to get all this testimony in. Need you to speed it up as you can, possibly.
Okay. Good timing, Mr. Chair. I think this is the last slide.
Okay.
Okay. So what we're doing is we're saying that a placard holder may park as they can now, but they need to actually access the facilities. And what that does is it frees up the parking spaces for people that actually need them. And all other parking in a designated space is prohibited, and the mere possession of a placard is not sufficient grounds for parking itself. You need to be able to free up the scarce number of resources that are available. It's on the order of, I think, 4% of the spots that are out there are disabled parking. It reduces the risk of further injury or death to disabled people, and it permits them to function in society, which is the intent and spirit of the ADA. So the repeat risk-taking, there's another little aspect that we tossed into the bill, which says that it's essentially a three times in, you're out type of thing. It sends a message that representing the privilege over others is an actual right, is punishable. Was there one more? Yeah, there is. So I think the committee needs to ask itself the question, is disabled parking a right or a privilege? Under the ADA, disabled citizens have the right to access facilities. I think that's the right that the legislature has put in place with the current set of statutes, but I think there was an oversight on, like as I said, parking versus use. To exercise a right, disabled are given the privilege, which is a right over others' rights, of parking closest. And that notice of that privilege is given by the placard. And if you have a privilege over somebody, you should have the right to challenge that privilege at any time. If somebody is sitting in a car under the current statutes and they are disabled, I, as a citizen, can come up to them and ask them why they are parked in that spot and to produce matching identification with the placard. I can do that, or a peace officer can do that. What the bill does is it allows a citizen or officer to challenge whether the placard holder enters or leaves the vehicle, as opposed to just sitting in it. So as far as the enforcement issues which were brought up, I don't see any difference between what the current law enforcement is, which is observing the presence of a placard on a vehicle or challenging the vehicle's occupants. It has nothing to do with determining their medical history. There is no inquisition or privacy issue. What you're doing is you're matching placard to ID number. And if a person is jogging between a parking spot and a store, you should be able to ask that person to produce their ID with a match to the placard. That's what the bill is doing. It's taking it one step further by asking, by being able to ask the person to produce a matching ID. And as a condition of receiving a parking privilege, the holder is required to produce the match, just like it is today. Okay, so in terms of cost, of course, any legislation is your time. I appreciate your time today. And, of course, the impact, I think, is part of the original legislation in that I think that was left out. Law enforcement, there may be further fines revenues. That's hard to determine what the amount is. No additional enforcement resources are required beyond what's being done for the present law. As a matter of fact, I'd submit that there may be a friendly amendment that's possible that would allow disabled placard holders to enforce the law. In other words, the people most affected by this should be the ones that should be able to say, are you sure you're allowed to park here? Can you produce the ID against the placard? So, as I said, there are alternatives. I don't see it as an impact on increasing our trooper count by 100 people or something. I think in terms of publicity, I think you'll get a media frenzy on this. People getting caught parking illegally in spots. It could actually be a draw in terms of media stings of people that are illegally parking. So, as I said, I think we can get creative on this. But the primary objective, as I said, is to actually produce enough parking spaces for people that actually need them.
Thank you, Andy. My question is, did you approach the school and ask them to create additional disabled parking spots?
Chairman Brown, that's a difficult thing to do. It's similar to the testimony that was being given here on the other bill recently, where, you know, we're talking about increasing the revenues for the highways when we're not efficiently utilizing the space that we have on the highways already. I think it's similar where, in terms of parking, 99% of the time those two spaces are vacant. So how can you in good conscience create a funding issue for the school in making a bigger parking lot? I don't think that's a wise thing to do.
I don't view it as making a bigger parking lot, just changing the designated use of the parking spots there. Did you ask them? Did you talk to them about
that? We've spoken to the school. They actually had words with the people that were parking inappropriately. But as I said, the school lot is full. And to reserve additional spots would mean having to create new ones. And as I said, we don't want a burden, given funding problems that we're all having right now, to pave more parking lot.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions? Thank you for your testimony this morning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Could I have Kelly Taylor, please?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Kelly Taylor with the Department of Transportation. I just wanted to give you just a little bit of history, and I'll do it very quickly. I've worked on disabled parking issues since the interim between the 87 and 89 session, and I've been on multiple work groups, including the one that did the big rewrite in 89, completely revamped the disabled parking laws. So I know this issue pretty much inside out and backwards. Many of the work groups have, through the years, have talked about this idea and have not gone forward with it because, frankly, for two reasons, it's just not enforceable. There is not much parking enforcement out there, and even the volunteer groups have been cut back. And so there's not many enforcement, there's not much enforcement out there, but even if there is enforcement out there, how do you prove someone has entered or left a vehicle? Are you supposed to feel the seat to see how warm it is, how long they've been sitting there? I mean, it's very, very difficult to do. And even if you could, just to get around this law, all the person has to do is get in or out of the vehicle once, and they've circumvented the law. This is one of those things where he's right. It isn't fair and it isn't just, but you can't legislate manners. You cannot legislate people being considerate of each other. That's the problem. And so that's why none of the work groups have ever come forth and said to do this, because, you know, maybe the person did get out and back in and out in a minute. Maybe they were going to get out, didn't feel well, decided to stay in. I'm not disagreeing that there's abuse. That's one of the things that the work group has looked at through the years is ways to cut back on abuse. That's why they're tied to the persons that are licensed RD card. That's why they have an expiration date, etc. I'm just here to say we've never come forth with this because we just know it will not work because you can get around it too easy, even if you could try to prove the person got in and out of the car, and there's virtually no way to do that.
Thank you, Kelly. Any questions? Thank you again for your testimony. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3253 and open a work session on House Bill 2432. And Janet, maybe it's been some time since we worked the bill. Can you briefly tell us about the bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2432, you heard in the middle of February, it eliminates the helmet requirement for motorcycle and moped operators and their passengers if those operators and passengers are over 21 or over. You did hear a round of testimony. If there are any questions, there's representatives from DHS, ODOT, and Bike Pack in the audience, but no, this is a work session, not a continued hearing. A new piece of information at the hearing, we did not have the fiscal impact statement, so we put that at your place this morning. The fiscal impact is determinant. They do talk about medical assistance program and the traffic violation in income from traffic tickets. The third paragraph down is the Office of Medical Assistance Program. I think the issue there is that motorcyclists use it, their health insurance policy that covers them. They do not have personal injury protection typically and are not required to. So it's their health insurance, own health insurance policy that covers them. Thank you.
Thank you, Janet. The chair would move that House Bill 2432 be sent to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Representative Green.
Yes, Mr. Chair. I thought very hard and long about this. I've been receiving, I'm sure as others of you have, a lot of pressure on this from constituents and friends and others. But my sense as a public health professional is that we need to oppose this bill, and that I think the place to oppose it is here in committee rather than on the floor, where we've had the chance to really consider what's going on. My analysis working with Abate and Bike Pack on creating the report that I distributed to you had a few very clear conclusions, along with a lot of things that we weren't able to find data on, like, for example, the fiscal impact, which is one thing we were not able to determine. But what we did determine is that at certain rates of speed, over about 10 miles an hour and below, I think the number is 40 miles an hour, that helmets do protect against head injuries. Against head injuries, the data were very clear on that, and that at certain rates of speed, it really makes a difference. If you wrap a motorcycle into a bridge at 75 miles an hour, it doesn't matter whether you're wearing a helmet or a head or anything else, you're not going to be helped. But at moderate speeds, it does make a difference. Secondly, we determined that in states that gave up mandatory helmet laws, between 25 and 30% of motorcycle riders did not wear helmets, even though the official arms are very good at stressing motorcycle safety, at teaching people to use helmets, and the people who support this bill also support, honestly and believing, support the notion that helmets should be worn. But about 25 to 30% of the people don't wear helmets. My estimate in using Oregon statistics was that taking this law will result in about somewhere between 5 and 10 extra deaths a year, not a huge amount, and we couldn't really determine the extent to which it would result in extra hospitalizations. You know that there's a downward thrust. We weren't able to, but I think 5 to 10 deaths is right. The thing that finally determined me is riding in a car with my grandchildren a few weeks ago when I tried to start the car before they had a chance to put their seatbelts on. And they had a fit. I mean, I was about to kill them. It was just this fit. And it took me back to the days when we had children that age and didn't even have seatbelts in cars. I mean, seatbelts came about just about the time my kids got that age. And our kids banged around in the back of a station wagon, as I'm sure some of the others of your kids did, and happily survived. But what we've done is we've changed the culture around the use of seatbelts in cars over what's a little less than two generations, 35, 40 years, to the point that we're now children get in a car, they put seatbelts on. And if their parents don't, they tell their parents to put their seatbelt on because they don't. They also tell them not to smoke and some other things that we've managed to do. That if we establish a principle that it's okay for adults not to wear helmets, then while we tell kids helmets are the right thing to do, they're watching what's going on, and their idea is, well, as soon as we're adults, it's going to be okay not to wear a helmet, that it's an adult thing, and we need to prove I'm an adult by not wearing a helmet as fast as we can. As long as we require everybody to wear helmets, I think over a couple of generations, we build the notion that helmets go with motorcycling in the same way we've built the notion that helmets go with hockey players. Representative Zahner and I were talking about the days when I first started watching hockey in Detroit, where the goalies in hockey, even where nobody wore helmets and nobody wore face masks. And I remember when the first goalie, Jacques Plante of the Montreal Canadiens, decided to wear this grotesque face mask, he was booed out of arenas. I mean, it was just horrible. And now you wouldn't think of, in pro or other places, playing hockey without helmets or without face masks, and nobody thinks about it because it's become a part of the culture of the sport. And it seems to me it's very important for us to enforce the notion that helmets are right, and it's not just kids need to wear helmets and adults don't need to wear helmets. It's that everybody wears helmets, and it becomes very similar to the seatbelts in cars. So from a public health perspective, I'm going to vote against this, and I'm, in spite of the heat I'm taking from some of my friends, and I'm going to urge others of you to join me in this and to do it at the committee where we really have had the chance to consider the issue.
Thank you, Representative Greenlight. That sounds like a very good floor speech.
Yes,
Representative Zahner.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'm going to vote for the bill for a couple reasons. I'm an avid biker, not in the league of Representative Dingfelder, but I'd venture to say that we probably have more head injuries for adults that ride bicycles because they're not forced to wear helmets, and they choose not to. I wear my helmet, but when I go to Sun River and watch everybody on the bike path, the parents have all the kids riding with helmets on, but they don't wear them, and I wonder who's going to take care of them when they hit their head, and it has nothing to do with speed. And on a bike, you can go pretty fast. I'm also a skier, and I wear a ski helmet. I have some friends that have hit trees and had falls and are paying the price because they can't ski anymore, and they've had severe head injuries. So that's my choice. So that's the way I feel about this bill. I feel the ones that want to wear their helmets should wear their helmets because of safety, and the ones that don't, they're over 21, they should be able to make their choice. So those are my comments. Thank you, Mr.
Thank
Chair.
Thank you, Representative. Any other comments? Seeing none, Ryan, will you call the roll, please?
Representative Zahner.
Aye.
Representative Beyer.
Aye.
Representative Dingfelder.
No.
Representative Gilman.
No.
Representative Greenlight.
No.
Representative Mabry.
Aye.
Chair Brown.
Aye. Motion carries, and we'll ask Representative Krupp to be the carrier. I think he was the sponsor on the bill. And committee, thank you for your indulgence this morning. It went a long time. Monday and Wednesday next week, we reserve room 343 for afternoon meetings, and hopefully 2 to 4, I believe, wasn't it?
Sure.
Yeah, Janet says she'll get back to us before then. Thank you.
Janet. Still start at 8:30,
yes, still at 8:30, yeah.
Unless you want to start earlier.
Yeah.
No, here.
Yeah. And with that, we're adjourned.